Okay, good morning. Good morning, everyone. And welcome to part five. Before we begin, just a reminder that today is actually the last one of the term, last one of the year. Just wanted to mention before I forget, I'll try and mention at the end just for those that maybe come in a few minutes late. Yeah, we're all ready? So as I said, this year is today's the last one of this term in this year. The new series next year begins on the 31st of January. That's a Thursday at the end of January. That's the first Thursday of the next term. And the topic for next year is, I'm calling it Precious Seconds. And the basic idea is that it's a combination of, what we're going to do is, it's about making every day meaningful with two different things, effective time managing properly and also a good attitude. So it's about making the best out of every day. That's the topic. I think it's going to be an exciting topic. So, 31st of January. But also, I wanted to just mention again, I mentioned this last week, but just to mention again, that we do have a learning program before that, and that's the summer learning program, which is on the December the 25th to January the 1st. And for the first 5 days of that program, as we did last year, we introduced a stream in the first hour of what I call the best of personal growth. And it's for men and women, so it's a good chance to bring your husbands if you want to drag them along. And what I'm going to do is take some of the things we've done over the last year or two and condense them and share with you. You'll see the emails, you'll see the topics. So that's December the 25th. So today we break. Please God, I go overseas next week, and then I'll return before the summer learning program. And we'll have the program, and then the next term starts on Thursday, the 31st of January. Okay, so before we launch into today's topic, just to do a bit of review. So far we've developed five concepts, today's the sixth, but we've developed five ideas in terms of nurturing and discovering our self-worth and self-perception, healthy self-esteem. The first one was learning to define our core identity, to understand who we are, to make sure that we define ourselves not by the approval of others and not even by the approval of ourselves. In other words, not to define ourselves even by our own strengths and weaknesses. Those are just garments. Those are outside things. But to define ourselves by our intrinsic worth, our core soul, the spark, the essence of who we are. Following from that, number two is using that then to nurture our strengths, to understand that we are the goodness that we always retain or in control, to improve our strengths and to nurture them. The third one was that specifically when we don't define ourselves by our weaknesses, then we can actually take responsibility for them because they're not us. It's not how we are. We are beyond them. We can now work with them, repair them, improve on them, but they don't define who we are, but we can and we must grow and take responsibility for them. Last week we did another two. Last week we talked about the messages that we play in our brain, the conversations we have with ourselves, and rewriting the script, in other words, to ensure that we have sentences and we take a step back when things happen and we understand what is behind what is happening, what is behind our responses, what is behind the things that we do. And sometimes it's negative messages that we're playing in our own brain, in our own thought process, because as we said last week, we live in the world of our thoughts. So it's about rewriting that script. And finally, last week, we also talked about building self-esteem in others. If we want to define ourselves by our own intrinsic worth, we need to learn to do that for other people as well. And when we look at a person and understand them and identify them by who they really are, not by the behavior or their strengths or their weaknesses, then we can learn to do that with ourselves as well. So that's so far. Today we need to then conclude and go to the final step. And the final step really is, I suppose, summarizes and encapsulates everything we've done till now. And it's really probably the most critical step of all. But it can only really come after we've understood everything that we've done till now. And that critical step is called letting go. And letting go is a very difficult thing to do. See, when we take the concepts that we've discussed in the first five components, first five concepts, then we have to put it into practice. And putting it into practice and really defining ourselves in a healthy way, understanding that potential that is within us, understanding that definition of who we really are, not defining ourselves by others, working on our strengths, working on our weaknesses, it requires one major thing. It requires us to become untrapped and to let go from hanging on to that negative self-perception that we have. Because as we've talked about many times, subconsciously at least, many of us do have a negative self-perception, for whatever reason. Many of us do live in a culture where we define ourselves by other people. Many of us are, in an unhealthy way, seeking approval from others, beating ourselves up when we have our weaknesses, not believing we can have competencies or we have strengths, whatever the expression or manifestation of our unhealthy self-perception is. And in order to implement all the things we've talked about, it actually requires a realization. It requires us to acknowledge that we sometimes, either consciously or subconsciously, we hang on to that negative self-perception. And we hang on for a reason. And in order not to hang on to it, in order to let go of it, we need to learn how to let go and why we're hanging on. And the reason that we hang on, and this is something that Rabbi Dr. Tversky writes a lot about, is a concept called payoffs. See, it pays to have a negative self-perception, or at least we think it pays. We think there's an advantage in having a poor, unhealthy perception of ourselves. Because there's a lot of things that happen, or we think happens, which have short-term benefit, right? But it really is short-term, and that's the problem. There are a lot of things that happen that have short-term benefit when we hang on to that old negative perception of who we are. Sometimes the payoff is attention. It's a way to get attention. Rather, in other words, it's like the path of least resistance. If I play victim, if I put myself down, if I get insulted very quickly, I'm able sometimes to gain attention from others that might be easier to get rather than going through the path of taking responsibility for myself, working on my strengths. That takes a lot of strength. That takes a lot of time. Ultimately, it'll bring the healthy recognition from others, but it takes time. So we hang on. We have this perception that it's sometimes easier, it's just easier to be a victim. To blame myself, I'm sorry I couldn't do it. Sorry, you know, that's who I am, I'm really sorry, I'm nebuch, I'm not talented, I just don't know how. So why didn't you speak to that, why didn't you have that conversation last week? I couldn't, it's just not me, I couldn't, I was too shy. Couldn't have the conversation, I was scared of failure, I was scared of rejection, right? It's easy, it's just easy, it's an easy way out. We're scared of failure. We're scared of failing. So the easier option is just to put myself down. Put myself down so I can't do it. Put myself down or get really hurt or offended very quickly so I have a lot of attention. So I'm making sure that people are, I'm becoming the focus. It's a very negative way to become the focus, but people do that. And there can be many, many, many other things and it's all part of the payoff, all part of the subconscious, easier route that we take to hang on to that negative self-perception that we have of ourselves. Now, of course, when we talk about hanging on, when we talk about being stuck somewhere, the most important one, and the most important one of letting go, is the concept of blaming. Right? We all have reasons why we are the way we are. A long list of reasons. It's our father, it's our mother, the principal when I was in grade 3, it was the teacher when I was in year 4, right? Some of them, by the way, are very legitimate. When I was in year 5, I was bullied. Now, by the way, that's a serious thing. I'm not trying to minimize that part of it. It is a serious, serious thing when someone is bullied, when a child is bullied, for example. And bullying a child can leave scars for life. That's true. And that's something that the person who bullies needs to be aware of. But it's not something that a 47-year-old should be hanging on to. Right? Part of understanding that in the core essence of who we are, our core identity is that intrinsically pristine, pure, powerful, infinite, divine spark at the very, very basis of our soul, means that who we are never changes, and that anything that happened to us that damaged us, whether we did it to ourselves or whether other people did it to us, ultimately is up to us to deal with. Ultimately, it's our choice. Harder, easier, but it's our choice. It's the factors that influence the way we grow up, and we've talked about this many times, the factors that caused me to be where I am. The circumstances of life that maybe accelerated my negative perception of myself is all real. It's not that it's not real. So is my genes, by the way, real. I've shared this with you many times. It's not only genes. You know, the Talmud talks about, genes, of course, are one. Genes are what we inherit from our parents. But it's not just genes. There's spiritual effects. There's the makeup of our personality in terms of our soul. There's the day you were born in. There's the hour you were born in. I've shared this with you before. The Talmud talks about different dispositions of personalities that a person has if they're born in a particular hour of the day, because there are seven. Seven planets that rotate, and each one governs a different hour. Did you know that? Yeah? Maybe one. I did this many years ago. Maybe I'll share it with you one time again. It's not for today. It's very fascinating. Because you can actually work out which planet you're born under. It's not a hard thing. It's actually quite clear. Every day, it works in a cycle of 7 days. And it starts again every 7 days. Like I so happen to know, I'll just give you an example, that on Friday evening between 6 and 7 is Mars. That's one of the stars. It's not a good planet to be born in, by the way. Yeah. The Talmud says if you're born in Mars, you want to hear this? The Talmud says if you're born in the hour where the planet of Mars governs, you have murderous tendencies. That's a very powerful thing. But listen to this. So what should we do now? I didn't mean. Yeah, that's right. Oh, good memory. I didn't mean double of a kind of words. So what should we do now? You see, this is a powerful thing, right? What should we do when a person is brought to court for murder? Should we work out which hour he's born in? Should we absolve him because he was born in the hour of Mars? By the way, the court system almost does things like that today. Does not quite like that. They don't look in the Talmud, but right. But they do say, you know, we do it. I mean, I just read something the other day. It was ridiculous. Someone killed his wife in the States. Because she wanted a divorce. Good reason to kill someone. I mean, like, you know. And the defense came up with this thing that he must have been provoked. So it's not, what do they call it? It's not murder, but it's manslaughter or something. I've forgotten the different levels, right? So he should get less prison time because, you know, it wasn't really his fault. He was provoked and out of control. A human being is always in control. Was it a more difficult decision? Yes, of course. Right? So going back to the Talmud, it's a powerful thing. I think I've shared this with you before. The Talmud says someone is born in the hour of Mars, so he has murderous tendencies. What should he do? So he says he should become a surgeon or a sheikhet. Right? That's a very powerful thing. You know why? Because all it means is... it means two things. It means that the factors that influence and shape who you are very real, but you're not bound by them because you can always channel them. You can control them. Or not even better than control, you can channel them into something positive. Right? At the end of the day, to be a surgeon in an operating theater needs someone who's not squeamish, right? If everyone would faint at the sight of blood, we'd be in big trouble. Yeah? So you can channel them. But the point is this, the point is there are numerous factors that govern a person and shape a person. There's the spiritual genes, there's the hour you're born, there's the day, the week you're born in the Talmud says. There's the parents you have, in terms of there's the surroundings, your environment, and of course there's the parenting that you experienced. Right? And somehow every person that grows up finds some sort of fault in the way they were parented, often. And then vows never to make the same mistakes, and then finds themselves doing exactly the same thing as their parents did. Right? And then there's the teachers we had, and we are, and they're very real. Some were good teachers, some weren't, some were terrible. A teacher can destroy a person's life, that's true. But that's why I'm just going on and on a bit, because it's such an important thing to look back and to know that subconsciously we do blame. We do blame, and we have a reason why we are the way we are. And particularly when it comes to the concept of self-perception and self-esteem, we often, if it's consciously or subconsciously, we blame and we have good reason why we have a negative perception in ourselves, and the good reason is right. But we have to let go. And that's a big step. The sixth thing is about understanding the definition of who we are, everything we've talked about the last few weeks. Understanding how we play those positive messages in our brain, and then to make a conscious decision that notwithstanding, not that they're not real, we're not in denial here, not that they're not real, notwithstanding the real causes of who I am, I'm going to let go. I am a person, at the end of the day, I understand that I make a choice. I make a choice whether I'm going to let my parenting and my teachers and my friends and my environment and my genes and the hour I was born in, whether I'm going to let it affect me, or I'm not going to let it affect me. Because at the end of the day, that core intrinsic soul that I have far surpasses and is transcends and is more powerful and more infinite than all of the factors that shaped me and influenced who I am. Because all of those different things we've just talked about only affect the four outer layers, the garments of the soul. Nothing affects who I really am. And therefore it's up to me if I'm going to access my core identity and let it sprout and spread forth like the oil that we talked about, I think last week or 2 weeks ago. Or are we going to just get stuck in the layers and just blame the whole world for who we are? It's also easy. It's another payoff. If the payoff of self-perception, of a negative self-esteem, is that I have who to blame. It's easier that way. I don't have to take responsibility for myself. But all of these various payoffs are very limited and very, very finite. At the end of the day, they create unhappiness, they affect relationships, they affect productivity, they affect me going forward. If I make a conscious decision to let go, to actually let go of all of it, it's all true, but goodbye. That was it, I accept it, it was, it's true, I had a rough childhood or whatever it is, I let it go and I say, I am who I am going forward. It's about letting go of the past, it's about looking forward thinking, looking into the future, but actually more important than anything else, it's about focusing on the now. Right? There's a cute little saying, that I think, I don't know if it's in the Talmud or the Midrash or from some of the earlier sources, that says that the past has gone, the future hasn't come yet, and the present is a split second, so why worry? But in a similar way, the now is so important. In fact, the now is something we're going to talk about next term in the part of the discussion we're going to have next term. Is very, very important, how to focus on the now. And the focusing on the now is what really, really counts. We get inspired by the future. We are directed by what could happen in the future. We let go of the past and the negative part of it. We learn from the past too. We learn and we let go. We are driven and inspired what could happen in the future, but we focus on the now. And we focus on who I am right now. And who I am right now hasn't changed. It's just now I need to use that core identity and use it to nurture my strengths and to take responsibility for my weaknesses. But it's me who's taking responsibility. I'm letting go of the payoffs. I'm letting go of those perceived benefits that I might have from hanging on to those negative self-perceptions. And more particularly, I'm letting go of the past. I'm letting go of those who I want to blame, or the people I want to blame, or the places I want to blame. And I am who I am. So that's the sixth step, and I think it's the most critical one probably, because it's the most difficult. Because after all said and done, when we understand everything we've talked about till now, the hardest part is to actually say, okay, I'm going to let go and put it all into practice. So I want to just end off then, just by revisiting some of the concepts and sharing with you a few thoughts, just to sum up and to sort of put it all into perspective. At the end of the day, this concept we've talked about, this term of the way we define ourselves and the way we perceive ourselves, It's actually a critical thing, and it affects everything else. It's actually at the foundation of everything else. It's the foundation of how we manage our emotions. It's the foundation of how we manage our relationships, clearly, because we talked about anger and criticism and all these things, all is all tied in. And it's really at the foundation of how we perceive ourselves and therefore how we perceive other people. I'll just share with you an interesting thing. In the Chumash, there's a famous story of the spies, right? When Moses sent spies to the land of Israel, to spy out the land of Israel and to come back and report. In order that, in preparation for them going into Israel to conquer the land. And the spies came back, there were 12 of them, and we know the story. 10 of them unfortunately gave a very negative report. Interestingly, when do they come back? It's not the time of the year now, but when do they come back? They came back on the in the Jewish calendar on the day of Tisha B'Av, which is the 9th of Av. They gave this negative report. The Jews cried and were despondent, and God was upset, and He said, you cried today for nothing. This is going to be a day of crying. And ultimately, it became the day of destruction. It became the day where both temples were destroyed, and a lot of tragedies happened on the 9th of Av. If you look carefully at the report that they gave, they were very negative about their perception of the land of Israel. It's too difficult, it's fortified cities, they're too strong, we're never going to be able to conquer them. And then they say an amazing thing. They say, to paraphrase first, before we look at the exact words, they say that when we were in Israel, these are what the spies say when they come back, we saw giants. And the Midrash says, because there were parts of Israel where the real giants lived. And there were the Midrashic explanation of this verse is that they were in the orchard one day and they saw these huge dark giants. And they said that we were so small that they looked at us as if we were chagavim. Chagavim is locusts. Right? We were so small that they looked at us like insects. And of course the question is, how do they know? They didn't consult with them. How do they know the way the giants looked at them? But the answer is in the wording. Look what they say. And I'll just read it to you. It says, over there we saw the giants, and we were in our own eyes like locusts. V'chein hayinu be'einehem, and so we were in their eyes. See what it says? It's a double expression. We were in our own, in other words, it all came from the perception of ourselves. We are certain that they looked at us as a locust. As an insect. How are we so certain? Because that's how we felt about ourselves. You think someone else perceives you a certain way only because that's the way you perceive yourself. We are threatened and paranoid from other people because we think they look at us in a particular way, they define us a particular way, because that's the way we define ourselves. So it becomes a reality. In other words, the more we perceive ourselves that way, the more we are perceived that way. And it spreads out to everything. And I'm going to share with you a fascinating thing. The word for locust in Hebrew, just something I came across a few years ago, and it's an amazing idea. They came back on the day of Tisha B'Av, right? The day of the destruction of the temple, ultimately. And they said that we viewed ourselves like locusts. Now, why locusts of everything? It could have been any insect, but they chose the locust. Now, you know, in the Chumash, there's a translation, an Aramaic translation, right? An Aramaic translation called the Targum. The Targum is the very first translation before Archscrollos and Sino, right? It's the very first translation of the Chumash. In fact, the Talmud says that it was written by a great sage called a man called Uncalus, who was actually a convert, a Roman convert, but he was a tremendous sage. And he wrote it with divine inspiration. It's not just a translation, but it's a divinely inspired translation. And it's written in Aramaic, which was the dialect of the time when he lived. And in fact, there was an ancient custom in the shuls many centuries ago that in shul, when they used to read the Torah on Shabbat, there would be a translator, and they would read a few verses, and then the translator would say the Targum, right? Today it wouldn't be of any benefit, because if someone said the Targum today, it would be more difficult than the Hebrew, because Aramaic is more difficult than Hebrew for us, at least. And it's interesting, the Aramaic, it's interesting dialect, it's not quite a dialect of the Talmud, it's a bit of a different Aramaic context. Anyway, when he translates this verse, when they said that we were in our own eyes like locusts and so we were in their eyes, he translates the verse, he translates the word chagavim, which is locusts, into an Aramaic word called kamtzin. Kamtzin, which probably means locust in Aramaic. Now why am I telling you this? Because all this happened on the 9th of Av, when they came back and they reported this back, right? Later on, the second temple was destroyed on Tisha B'Av, and the Talmud tells us, why was the second temple destroyed? The Talmud says Jerusalem was destroyed because of baseless hatred. And the story of baseless hatred is rooted in a particular story, a very famous story of two individuals, Kamtze and Bar Kamtze. Note the same word, Kamtze, Kamtzin, same word. What was the story of Kamtze Bar Kamtze? The story was that there was a person in Jerusalem who made a banquet. Right? Listen to the story. A person who made a banquet and he wanted to invite his friend. He had a very, very, very close friend called Kamtze. And the invitation got lost, as it happens sometimes, and the invitation got lost, and it went to the wrong address. Who did it go to? The deliverer, the postman, delivered it to another person called Bar Kamtze, because he mixed the two people up. Right? It was a person called Kamtze, a person called Bar Kamtze. Now, this particular person who made the banquet doesn't say his name. It says that he wanted to invite Kamtze, because he was very close with Kamtze, but actually Bar Kamtze was an enemy of his. Right, so the invitation, instead of going to his close friend, lands up at his enemy. Bar Kamtze is overjoyed that he's been invited to this guy. Finally, there's going to be a resolution to this conflict. And he shows up to the party. So it doesn't say the name of the guy who made the party, but the guy, the balabos, the host, comes over to him and he says, excuse me, out. So he was very embarrassed. Right? So he says to him, please, let me stay and I'll pay for my meal. It won't cost you anything. He says, absolutely not. Absolutely not. You need to get out. So in desperation, he says to the host, I'll pay for half the banquet. He says, absolutely not. The guy says, you know what? I'll pay for the whole banquet on my account. Here's my credit card. Right? And he says, absolutely not. And he throws him out. Throws him out. Talmud says, this guy was furious. So he went and he slandered. He made up a story to the Roman emperor that the Jews are going to rebel. A whole long story, which we're not going to enter now. That he tested them, he sent a sacrifice, and they didn't bring in a whole business anyways, and that was the cause of the Roman army coming to Jerusalem and just ultimately destroying the temple. Now, we have an interesting question. Let's look at the words of the Talmud. The Talmud says that Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamtze and Bar Kamtze. Now, hold on a second. Jerusalem wasn't destroyed because of Kamtze or Bar Kamtze. Jerusalem was destroyed because of the host. Kamtze didn't do anything wrong. Kamtze wasn't even part of the story. He didn't even get the invitation. Bar Kamtze was engaged, but he was the victor. The main problematic guy of the story is the host. We don't even know his name. So what does the Talmud mean that it was destroyed because of Kamtze and Bar Kamtze? But I think the message of this Talmud is this, and it goes back to this discussion that we're talking about here. Kamtze is the same word as Kamtzin, which is the Aramaic for locust. And it goes back to that perception that the spies had, that we were in our own eyes like locusts. Let's examine the story. Let's examine the attitude of both the host and Bar Kamtze. They're both desperate to stay there. Absolutely desperate to stay there. No, the Bar Kamtze is desperate to stay there. The host is desperate to get him out. Why? Why? The Talmud refers to it as baseless hatred. Why do people have baseless hatred? What is baseless hatred? Let's view that. The famous thing, the temple was destroyed because of simnat chinam, baseless hatred, where you cannot tolerate someone else really for no reason. Why would a person not tolerate someone else for no reason? And the answer goes to Kamtze. It's all about Kamtze. It's about how we review ourselves. If we are so insecure, if we have such a negative perception of ourselves, if we view ourselves as locusts, as kamtzin, we have to fight for our own identity. And anything on the outside threatens us. There's no room for another person. For no reason. There's just no room for the next person because I'm too busy defending my identity. I'm too busy defending myself. I'm too busy making sure that I'm noticed, that I am not threatened, that I'm not perceived as weak by other people because I'm fighting to the last straw for that weak, fragile, insecure self of who I think I am. That's what ego is. Ego is a manifestation of a bad perception of oneself. It's about not having room for anyone or anything else. If Kamtze or Bark, in other words, it was a time of Kamtze and Bark, that's what the Talmud means. The Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamtze, Bark, Kamtze, not those particular two people. It was destroyed because there was this disease of Kamtze and Bar Kamtze. there was disease of poor perception of self, and therefore the ego was rampant. And because ego was rampant, there was no room for another person. In that story, why did he kick him out? Why was he so desperate? Why does it bother me if I make a banquet and reception and an enemy of mine turns up? So he turns up. There's 300 people there. It's not going to cost me extra. Another gefilte fish. So what? No. It's about you might see me letting my enemy in. And therefore I'm worried that you're going to think, oh, he's buckling in. Giving up. I don't want to be seen as weak. The truth is that to allow the enemy to stay is the greatest strength, not the greatest weakness. If I had a real good perception of myself, I would of course let him in because I'm not defined by other people. I'm strong enough to say I have plenty of room, even for those that I don't like. Even the guy who's fought to stay there, the truth is, why don't you just leave? Now, he was a victim. We never should blame the victim. It's not a good thing to do. But if you dig deeply, at the end of the day, we're always so desperate to stay. Okay, no one wants to be humiliated. But the truth is, he probably also had a kamtzah perception of himself. Because if he didn't, he would have said, goodbye, good morning. I'm fine without you. And he could have gone home. But no, says the Talmud, there was a kamtzah and bar kamtzah disease that was all around. And bar kamtzah and bar kamtzah disease spreads baseless hatred. Baseless hatred is a direct result of a poor self-perception of ourselves that brings us to not be able to make room for others. And making room for others is the very basis of every single healthy relationship. It's what relationships are about, at the end of the day. Yes, good communication, conflict resolution, being able to respect, being able to be nice, being able to be compassionate, make room to give, to take, all the things we've talked about when we talk about healthy relationships. But what's at the core of it all? At the core of it all is that I'm not busy defending myself. I'm okay with myself. I'm okay with myself to express my needs. I'm okay with myself not to disappear, not to disintegrate and dissolve, which is also a very, very big part of relationships. But I'm also okay with myself to make room for you. And therefore, once each person can make room for the others, it's all progress from there on. So, this concept that we've talked about, this is critical. It's critical to how we take criticism. It's critical to how we get angry. I mean, getting angry, again, anger management is a very, very, very big topic. But at the core of it is also this concept of self-esteem. Why do we fly off the handle when something happens that threatens us or provokes us? It's all because we feel threatened. At the very base of why do we do things that are not good for ourselves? Why do we engage in behaviors and practices that are harmful, whether physically or spiritually or psychologically or emotionally, all these things? Why do we do it? If we liked ourselves, if we actually had a good perception of ourselves, we wouldn't do it. So therefore, what I wanted to bring out is that the concept... This series, really, this concept of understanding who we really are and becoming comfortable with that and accepting who we are and understanding that we remain intrinsically a good person, that it means we're able to nurture our strengths and to take responsibility for our weaknesses, we're not defined by them, we're not defined by other people, actually becomes the core of most issues in life. That's the truth. And that takes away the concept, that encourages baseless love rather than baseless hatred, and encourages healthy relationships and good practices and productivity and achieving all these things, confidence, healthy confidence, that is, all of these things are an outcome of the way we view ourselves. And the way we view ourselves directly affects how others view us also, because if we view ourselves like locusts, other people look at that as well. I wanted to end off, that was really a concept for the 9th of Av, which is the wrong time of the year. But we're in a happier time of the year. And I know it's still a few weeks away, but since this is the last year, I thought I'd share with you something that's very much connected with the whole garments concept, which I might have done in previous years in a different way, but it's about Hanukkah. And it's about the dreidel. We all know that on Hanukkah we have two customs, besides the mitzvah of lighting Hanukkah candles, which is a beautiful mitzvah. It's about generating light, growing every day. Every day we add a candle. But Hanukkah also has customs. And part of the customs have to do with oil, eating donuts. Not too many, but yeah. Right? Latkes, donuts. And then, of course, there's the minag, the custom of playing the dreidel. The sivivon, the spinta. Now, put it there on your handout because, okay, playing the dreidel essentially has an historic origin. They say that in the times of the Greeks and the times of the Romans, when they prohibited Jews from studying Torah. So what used to happen is the kids, the students would come and they would go into hiding and study. And then someone would be on the lookout. And if suddenly they saw a patrol coming to inspect, if they were going to be studying or not, they'd put away the books or put away the manuscripts. And they would take out these spin tops to play a game. And that became the historic origin of playing the dreidel. What's the significance of the four letters that are on the dreidel? So we know that on the dreidel there's four letters. Nun, Gimel, Hey, and Shin, and I put them if you know. And it's an acronym. It stands for Nes Gadol Hayasham. A big miracle happened there. That's the simple reason. But we have a tradition that any custom that it develops among Jewish communities always just doesn't just happen. It happens by divine providence. And therefore, when customs develop, there's a phrase in the Talmud that a minag, a custom that exists within Jewish communities, is part of the Torah, it becomes holy. It's got a holiness to it, it's got a depth to it. It doesn't just happen. And therefore, the custom of playing dreidel actually has a very, very deep idea behind the whole custom. But let me just go back to the first custom of eating donuts. Of course, we eat donuts because we emphasize that the miracle happened with oil. Now let me take you back to, was it last week I did the thing with oil? Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? Whatever it was. Anyway. Yeah. Last week?
Last week.
Okay. Let me take you back to that oil concept, right? Where, just to recap, the prophet said to the woman who said everything's falling apart, so he said to her, what do you have at home? And she said, I have that little bit of oil, a jug of oil, right? And then he said, go and bring all the empty vessels from outside the home, put it next to the oil will spill over. We explained that it was the same imagery as the garments. The vessels, the empty vessels, the ones that had been corrupted and messed up, that was all outside the home. That wasn't what defined her. What defined her was a little bit of oil, the pure oil that she had, which was her core identity, and that then sprouted out and fixed everything else up. So it's interesting that Hanukkah also is about the miracle of oil, the miracle about the one little jug of oil that remained with the seal of the high priest. And of course, on a spiritual level, what this means is, and the Kabbalists explain this at length, that at the time of Hanukkah, the Greek-Assyrian culture was very strong. The Hellenization was very strong. The culture of Hedonism and distorted thinking was very, very strong. There was a tremendous spiritual war that was being waged against the Jewish people, and many of the Jewish people were succumbing to the influences of that culture. And it appeared that almost the Assyrian army would actually prevail, and they would actually be able to influence the culture of the Jewish nation. And then suddenly the Hanukkah story happened with this little jug of oil. And the concept there is that as much as they were influenced only on the outer layers, right? But they weren't actually, there's always that pintaliyid, there's always that little bit of neshama, there's always that soul that is always there. And that soul, that essence of the soul, once again is represented by the little jug of oil with the seal of the high priest. It's always intact. It's always holy, it's always pure, it's always there. And in the context of our discussion, that whole idea is very, very much reflected in the dreidel. What I'm going to share with you comes partly from an article, an essay written by Rabbi Yossi Jacobson, who bases it on a piece of a great sage called the Bnei Yisaskar. He was a Hasidic Rebbe who has some very beautiful and creative insights sometimes into the various festivals. And he says like this, that the four letters on the dreidel represent four different layers of how we operate. And it's interesting because it's very much connected to the four outer garments that we talked about a few weeks ago. So he says the following. If you have a look at your handout, you'll see that the nun stands for nefesh, the word nefesh. The gimel stands for the word guf. The hay stands for the word hara, negative, and Shin stands for the word Seichel. Now, talks about four negative, four destructive, four evil sort of practices that a person can engage in. The one he talks about is the idea of Nefesh. Nefesh means the soul who I am, not the inner soul, not the essence of the soul, but it refers more to the irrational ego that a person has. Sometimes people act in an arrogant way that is totally irrational. It's just an expression, a negative expression of self. And that's represented by the concept of nefesh. That's the nun. The gimel stands for guf, stands for body. And he says what that talks about is bodily urges. It's the desire, the lust, the pursuits that a person has that is purely material and physical, right? Which are often destructive and negative. It's the urges that a person has to pursue pleasure in an excessive way. The hay stands for hara, which means evil, destructive behavior. And that refers really to the way a person behaves, which is just a bad thing. Bad behavior, destructive behavior, ineffective behavior. And the shin stands for the word seichel, which means thinking, which is thought, which refers to distorted views, distorted thinking. Now, if you examine those, they correspond to the, not in the same order, but they correspond to the four layers of the soul, right? The nun, the nefesh, refers to who I am beyond rationale, refers to the subconscious. That's the... It's
the
pay.
Last letter is the pay.
Yeah.
What happens then?
So that's a very, very good question. I think it's more in jest. Someone wrote this. When I saw this article, someone wrote a note that the pay could be pay or fay, right?
It's there.
Shaman pay, correct.
There,
right. Yeah. So if you use the English language, you can get around it. Just like shin stands for seichel, which is intellect. The fey stands for philosophy. That's what he says. But it's more of a joke, I think. But anyway.
Right.
Okay, but it works here. I don't know.
Sorry.
Anyway, by the way, it could be a more of a modern thing that they've substituted the shin for the pay. It's interesting research. I'm not sure it was always that way, because I think it could be that the shin was always there. But anyways. So the nun, which means nefesh, which is the soul beyond rationale, refers to the subconscious. Right? If you skip the shin, which is seichel, thinking is the layer of cognition, which we spoke about, the layer of intellect. The gimel, which stands for guf, which is represents the urges of the person, that's emotion. Those desires and those pursuits come from the emotional needs that people have, negative needs, that is. And of course, the hay, which stands for hara, which is destructive behavior, refers to the layer of action, which is the most outer layer. Right. So they correspond in very much the same way, the outer layers that we spoke about. Now, remember, I think it was last series we spoke about that the truth is that a person operates on two levels. Because we have we have two souls, right? Two parts of our personality. We have the godly soul and the animal soul, right? So the animal soul normally is the animalistic part of the person, and that's where normally a person, unless they channeled it and trained it well, the animal soul will be the result of some of these negative things that we're talking about here on these four layers. But there's a very fascinating Kabbalistic concept, and that is this. That when we talk about the five layers of the soul that only exist within the godly soul, the animal soul, the animalistic part of a person doesn't have five layers, only has four layers. Which goes to the heart of everything we've been talking about. Because the struggle, the war between good and evil, between positive and negative, between what is effective and ineffective, appropriate and inappropriate, can only happen on the four levels. And sometimes the positive wins, and sometimes the negative wins. It's like in this week's parasha, when Isaac gives birth to two children, Yitzhak and Rivka, Esav and Yaakov, right? And it says when Rivka was pregnant, she was struggling. And she went to consult a prophet to see what was going on, because the baby, she thought she had one baby, and the baby was vacillating between one thing and another, right? There's a famous little medrash that Rivka, when she would walk past a house of learning, Yaakov would try and come out. And when she walked past a house of pagan worship, Esav was trying to run out. And she didn't know what kind of kid I have. What's this meshugan there? He can't make up his mind. One day he's in shul, the next day he's somewhere else, right? So she went to find out. So the prophet says, no, it's not one baby, it's two babies. And really, this story can be read on many levels, but on one level, the way the story is read is that the prophet tells her, what you're carrying is the eternal struggle that will always take place. You've got two forces, because all of your descendants will have two forces. They're all going to be carrying the struggle. Esav representing the animal part of the person, Yaakov representing the good part of the person. And they're going to struggle. And the prophet says a very, very interesting verse. In a way, it's a depressing verse. He says, when the one is victorious, the other one will be defeated. In other words, only one will win. So sometimes good will win, sometimes evil will win. Sometimes we will succeed, sometimes we will fail. But where does that struggle take place? That struggle only takes place in the Nun, Hey, Gimel, Shin. That's where the struggle takes place. And that's where sometimes the urges that I have, the emotions that I have are positive and healthy, and sometimes that's pursuit of pleasure and materialism. Sometimes I think with clarity, sometimes my thinking is distorted. Sometimes I act appropriately, sometimes I act in a destructive way, and the subconscious is the same thing. But Chanukah tells us that there's a fifth dimension, and that's the point of the dreidel. That's what the B'nai Yisrael says. The four sides of the dreidel is Nun, Gimel, Hei, Shin, the four layers that the animal soul has as well, and those are the four layers of human function that could be damaged. It could be destroyed. It could be weakened. And that's why you have the four negative Nun, Gimel, Hei, and Shin, which correspond to the positive. But in the time of Chanukah, it appeared that those four things, those four layers, were being defeated. The struggle was on the side of evil. Evil was defeating good. Esau was defeating Jacob, and the war was being won that way. That is an eternal struggle, and the struggle continues till today. But what we all have to understand is that there's a point of the dreidel, the spitz, as they call it in Yiddish, the little point of the dreidel that brings about the miracle of Chanukah. That point of the dreidel is a little bit of oil with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Every person has the point of the dreidel upon which we spin the four sides. To say that if you spin the four sides on the point of the dreidel, in other words, the point represents the essence, the definition, the core of who we are. And if we start with that little point and we understand who we are and then we work our way upwards into the four sides of the dreidel, then we'll be able to reframe and to rewire our whole existence. But it's understanding that no matter what happens and no matter what takes place with that struggle, no matter who wins the war on the four sides of the dreidel, on the four layers of the human function, on the subconscious, on the intellectual, on the emotional, on the behavior, nothing can ever destroy that little bit of oil. Nothing can ever destroy the point of the dreidel. And when we understand that, and that becomes our starting point for everything in life, relationships, the way we perceive ourselves, spirituality, emotionally, psychologically, whatever, when we start with that very, very essential point where we understand that's who we are, and it's pure, and it's good, and it's powerful, and it's godly, and it's infinite, then we can rebuild from there. On the four sides, sometimes it'll work, sometimes it won't. But we always go back. We always fall back with a little bit of the oil that is always pure and has always got the seal of the high priest intact, which is the essence of everything we've been talking about the last few weeks, and therefore it's very tied in to the whole message of Chanukah. That's what Chanukah is, and that's the lesson we have to take of Chanukah, and that's why we eat donuts, because we always have to remember that oil, the oil that is at the very, very basis of our soul. So have a great week and have a very, very good Chanukah. And thank you very, very much. And just to give you, I just, Rita, I don't have a choice with this, so Rita says she needs to say a few words.